Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. Coming to you live today in WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today, our guest will be Jennifer Ponsner, the Executive Director of Women in Media and News, one of the leading media critics in the United States, active working on women's issues and media criticism in general and politics. It should be a wonderful show today. I think you're going to enjoy hearing what Jen Ponsner has to say. So, get ready for a great program, but before we go to Jen Ponsner, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The Federal Communications Commission voted to approve the merger of the country's only two satellite radio companies, XM and Sirius. Sirius bought XM for $3.3 billion. Consumer groups and traditional radio broadcasters opposed the deal. Mark Cooper, Director of Research for the Consumer Federation of America, says that with a monopoly, there is no reason to stay competitive, which can affect price and talent.
We think the evidence is pretty clear that they actually did compete with each other. They went out and looked for talent. They developed formats. They advertised. They invested in research and development, the kinds of things that we associate with competition. If you look at the merger analysis, people thought that the way they were going to save money is to actually stop doing those things that reflect competitive rivalry.
Cooper says consumers can look forward to a loss of formats, less emphasis on new and creative programming, and fewer hosts with star power. In addition, depending on how the FCC actually words the order, the merger could set a precedent for future mergers among other media companies. The key word, Cooper says, is intermodal.
Essentially, what the XM and Sirius said were, even though we're the only two satellite radio service providers, there's other kinds of radio that consumers can listen to. There's terrestrial radio, plain old AM, FM radio. They talked about iPods and internet radio, none of which is really a substitute for the unique product that satellite was offering.
If the FCC accepts the premise that satellite radio had vigorous intermodal competition, it could open the door to more media consolidation.
In the long run, the great danger is that once you start accepting the intermodal competition argument, the whole fabric of regulation of media ownership starts to unravel because the TV broadcaster will come in and say, hey, look at all the other forms of entertainment the consumer has, so you ought to let us merge.
Watch what you're watching. Fox keeps feeding us toxins. Stop sleeping, start thinking outside of the box and unplug from the Matrix doctrine. But watch what you say, Big Brother is watching.
Hip-hop artist Nas joined protesters outside Fox News Channel in New York City on July 23rd to deliver more than 620,000 petitions demanding that Fox end its pattern of racist attacks against black Americans, including presidential candidate Barack Obama and his wife Michelle.
Call him Michelle Obama, Barack's baby mama. Tell me, is that acceptable? Is that racist?
Yeah.
Bill O'Reilly saying a lynching party. Do you know what that means? A lynching party for Michelle Obama might be legit. Is that acceptable?
No.
Is that racist?
Yeah.
The protest was organized by colorofchange.org, moveon.org, and Brave New Films. The signatures were gathered in less than a month. Andre Banks, deputy director of Color of Change, says that his organization, founded after Hurricane Katrina, to unite people around the idea that, regardless of race, every American should be respected, served, and protected, has been monitoring racism on Fox News.
What we're seeing is a pattern that didn't start with the Obamas, and it certainly won't end with the Obamas unless a greater action is taken, and we're trying to be a part of pushing for that larger action. So, I mean, the Obamas certainly have put a spotlight on what has been a very consistent pattern for Fox, and that is you know, using people's race to cast them as outsiders in their own country. And what we've seen with 620,000 petition signatures, it's something that Americans don't want to see. It's a conversation about race that sets us backward and doesn't move us forward, and it's not what anyone wants to see on Fox or elsewhere.
Come out that little studio and stand up here with the people. Like, man, stop standing behind a desk and dictating this BS to the public. Come outside with the people and let's see where your heart is. Let's see what kind of man you are. Say lynch party around some of these women out here and see what happens.
Watch, 'cause they watch. Watch what you watch. Better watch, 'cause they watch. Watch what you watch. Media misleading you. Watch what you watch.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, August 3rd, 2008, on WILL AM 580, based in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have a guest we've been wanting to get on for a long time. We're very privileged to have her here. Jennifer Posner founded Women in Media News in 2001. Its purpose, to increase women's presence and power in the public debate through media analysis, education, advocacy, and reform. Posner is a very highly regarded and widely published journalist and media critic. You've probably seen her work in the Chicago Tribune or Newsday, or seen her on Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN, where on each of those channels she's been a frequent contributor to the programming. Jen Posner, welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you so much, Bob.
Well, it's really great to have you here, Jen. I know how busy you are and what an active schedule you have, and here it is, your one day off probably that you get, and you're taking time for us, so we really appreciate it.
Oh, that's okay. I'm working today anyway. I'm writing my book on reality TV, so it's nice. It's actually a nice procrastinatory device.
Well, good. We're going to have a chance to talk. That's one of the subjects I know that our listeners are going to want to talk about and I want to talk about, which is reality shows. But before we get to that, Jen Posner, why don't you talk a little bit about Women in Media News, or I guess Women, W-I-M-N, why you founded it, what its purpose is, sort of a little bit about the history for people who might not be familiar with it.
Sure, absolutely. I founded Women in Media and News in late 2001, about a month or two after 9/11. So it was sort of an uphill battle, founding a women's media organization at a time when the funding world was redirecting funds so many, you know, crucial places. But I thought it was incredibly important. I was looking at, for example, the way women for Afghan women were trying to, this is a grassroots human rights organization in New York, had been trying for years to get any kind of media attention at all to the plight of women in Afghanistan, to the situation of oppression that they were facing under the Taliban, et cetera. And yet, right after 9/11, all of a sudden, we've finally found, media finally found Afghan women, but they were still not speaking with Afghan women. They were still not asking their perspectives on what their situation was and what solutions could help them at home and abroad. And instead, they were using mainstream media, that is, corporate media, that is, were using the image of Afghan women and the sort of symbol of Afghan women as a sort of a propaganda tool for war. And so, for example, one of the first things that Women in Media and News did in our efforts to try and branch out, not just from media monitoring, but into advocacy with women-led social justice groups, was work with Women for Afghan Women and give them media trainings and coaching and trying to help them become go-to sources and trying to help them learn how to not only challenge biased media coverage but also get their own stories into public debate. And that was one of the examples. That's sort of a story before telling you exactly what the mission of the organization is, but I feel like that story kind of gets across what part of what we want to do, which is analyze content and help people understand the news behind the headlines. That sort of speaks to my background as the Women's Desk Director. Before I founded Women in Media and News, I was the Women's Desk Director at Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, where you and I first met. but not sort of branching out beyond just content analysis for news and entertainment media, but also working with social justice groups to help them change content and improve content, and working with journalists and producers and bookers and editors to help them create better content as well. Because, you know, we know, you know, you've talked so often about how media consolidation and commercial interest in media ends up hindering good journalists' ability to do good work. So one of the ways that that manifests is, you know, the same seven white guys in suits that they've had in the Rolodex for 10 years end up getting called over and over and over and over because no one has time or resources to find new sources anymore. So we have a national network of women experts called the Power Sources Project. And that stands for Perspectives of Women Expand Reporting. And that is that has existed for about 7 years. And it's populated with women who are geographically diverse, ethnically diverse, and diverse in terms of the field that they work in. So that anytime a journalist, whether it's print or broadcast, corporate media or independent media, is working on a story and they need somebody to give them expertise or commentary, they can call a woman. They can call a woman who's working, you know, in economics for a story on the G8. They can call a female plumber for a story on home improvement because, you know, I know a woman who can snake a drain just like Bob Vila can. And so we have this national network, and that's been very successful in changing content on a case-by-case basis, outlet by outlet. And our last platform, our four prongs, our last prong is media justice work, looking at structural and institutional change and the ways to affect that, from media policy to institutional reform inside of outlets. And we work in coalition with some of the most important media justice groups in the country. And our role is specifically to act as a reminder and an advocate for women as a constituency for the media justice and media reform movements, and to act as an advocate for women within those movements.
Our guest today, Jen Posner, the founder and executive director of Women in Media and News. You're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone lines are open today if you want to call in for the question or comment for Ms. Posner. The phone number 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Jen, you mentioned Afghanistan and Afghani women. I recall back in the fall of 2001 and early 2002 how the plight of Afghani women, as you said, suddenly became a major concern of the Bush administration. We've seen a ramping up of interest in the war in Afghanistan by both presumptive presidential candidates in the last month or two. What is your sense? I haven't heard much about Afghani women, though, in the last month or two. What's happened to Afghani women in the 6 years since 2001 or 7 years?
Well, Afghan women's plight has, you know, basically dropped off of most of the media main stage shortly after their there was no longer a need in corporate media to use them as propaganda tools. And so you had a few pictures of triumphant visuals of Afghan women removing their burqas in major urban areas, and then all of a sudden, you know, accompanied with headlines about how American bombs had freed the Afghan women. Of course, we all know it's ludicrous. You can't free anybody through bombing them, but their actual status, their actual position in their country, as well as their human rights status officially, has not really been of much interest ever since, regardless of, you know, Laura Bush making and Condoleezza Rice making the rounds right after 9/11, talking about how important it was to care about Afghan women. Since then, we've seen increases in violence. We've seen ex-Taliban military folks and clerics taking power again. We've seen women basically fighting some of the same battles that they were before 9/11. We also have seen the fact that there was so much money, there were so many resources pledged to help Afghan women after 9/11, that hasn't really happened. Those monies and resources have been vastly under-resourced. Those women have very rarely gotten much benefit from all of those pledges. But the good news is that on the ground, women are really taking their fighting for their rights in the same ways they were before and very actively since that period of time, Women for Afghan Women and a group called RAWA, the Revolutionary Association of Women of Afghanistan, are from very different perspectives. One is a very radical group. One is the latter is a very radical group. The former works with women where they are, including works with very religious women. But they're fighting for their rights. They're building schools. They're educating girls, sometimes under vast threats. But, you know, to me, one of the things that was really interesting and incredibly inappropriate, I think, is how corporate media, through this very imperialist and very racist notion that, you know, all Arabs and all people of color must be the same and all Muslims must be the same, during the build-up to the Iraq War, media were somewhat complicit in giving the American public the notion that Iraqi women were facing some of the same or must be oppressed in some of the same ways that Afghan women were. And they would confuse people by showing women with headscarves in Iraq and then making it seem like women in Iraq had the same kinds of oppression and the same kinds of, you know, house arrest and not being able to go to doctors and being stoned in the street, all that, that women in Afghanistan were facing. In fact, at the time, before the invasion of Iraq, the U.S. invasion, women in Iraq, were among the freest women in that part of the world. They were, you know, perfectly able to work and own property and come and go as they pleased and et cetera, very cosmopolitan. And they were not required to have marriage and family come under Sharia law. After the U.S. invasion of Iraq, when Iraq enacted the new U.S.-endorsed constitution, very, very fundamentalist religious leaders were basically able to take over marriage and family law. And women in Iraq are now facing, it's setting women's rights back. It has set women's rights back in Iraq, you know, more than 100 years. And let me find a certain quote. I remember an NBC, a Meet the Press segment, around the time when the Iraqi constitution was being was being ratified, and the U.S. was endorsing it. I can't find the quote at the very moment, but there was a guest host on Meet the Press. It wasn't Russert at the time. I think it was David Gregory, and there was a former CIA guy. Or maybe FBI. In any case, the former government official, believe it was CIA, wish I'd known that we were going to be talking about this, I would have had a quote at my fingertips, but he was asked about to comment, which is very rare. They almost never even ask anybody about human rights, women's human rights abroad. But the guy was asked to comment on women's human rights being rolled back and Sharia law in the Constitution, and what did he think about that? Why was the U.S. endorsing that? And he said, well, you know, in the 1900s, women in this country didn't have the right to vote, and we think that since there's no mention in the proposed Constitution that Iraqi women shouldn't vote, that's the only thing that matters, and if Iraq could resemble American democracy in the 1900s, I think we'd all be thrilled. That was a direct quote. I remember that. I think we'd all be thrilled. And he ended it by saying, because women's social rights are not fundamental to the development of a democracy. And did Meet the Press come back with any kind of follow-up question? Did they grill him? Did they say, well, you know, if half of your population is disenfranchised from politics and law and family rights and human rights, how can that possibly be a democracy? No, no question. Just literally the only thing that was said was, thank you very much, and then they bumped to commercial, leaving the viewing audience and the listening audience with the vastly misogynistic idea that women are not valuable in a democracy.
Our guest, Jen Posner, Executive Director of Women in Media and News. You can learn more about them on their website, WIMN www.libertyonline.org. Phone lines are open here for folks who'd like to call in at 333-9455 or toll free 1-800-222-9455. You know, Jen, I've been reading your work. You've written numerous articles and op-eds in newspapers, done a lot of appearances on television over the years. And you've really carried on, I think, admirably with the entire wave of feminism that began in the 70s, which had a very strong concern with media issues built right into its DNA, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely.
And one of the core issues, and this is sort of the generation I was in, was made aware of as I came of age as a teenager, was the whole notion of how our media objectified women, sexually in particular. And this was something that in the 70s, I know a lot of us were very aware of, and it was talked about a lot, men and women. And I was wondering where you think our commercial entertainment system in particular stands today with regard to this issue of objectifying women.
I think that objectifying women has become the bread and butter of commercial media in terms of the entertainment realm. It's incredibly, incredibly lucrative in at least in the eyes of media owners and advertisers, to not only objectify women sexually, but to create sort of these narratives in which women are not only sex objects, but don't want to be seen or considered anything else. So we have the worst of this, I think, is the reality TV genre. I'm currently working on a book for Sale Press called, with the working title Bachelors, Bridezillas, and Beautiful Corpses. And it's all about unraveling reality TV's twisted fairy tales. And I look at the way that in the last 7 or 8 years, reality television has, in the guise of quote-unquote telling us our stories, telling us what reality is, has created very carefully calculated, scripted, manipulated narratives in which women are seen as, you know, always sexually available, always quote-unquote, you know, promiscuous or quote-unquote slutty, but never in control of their own sexuality, never self-aware. They're always called hot girls, even if they're in their 30s or 40s. They're never called adults. They're never treated as adults. And even worse than that, while the sexual objectification is going on, for example, on The Bachelor, a show, one of the most sexist of all the reality shows, a show where the premise is that, you know, one guy who no one knows gets showered with attention and competitive affection from 25 women who he whittles down week by week until he is contractually obligated to choose to supposedly want to marry one of them, and then they always end up breaking up about 2 or 3 weeks after they're no longer contractually obligated to date. But in the meantime, throughout the process of The Bachelor, they portray these women who always look like carbon copies of one another. They never even have, forget about intellectual diversity. They don't have any kind of physical or ethnic diversity among the castmates. It's always, you know, 25 women who look almost exactly alike. And the producer, Mike Fleiss, I believe it is, at one point said, oh, you know, this was on a primetime special about The Bachelor, said, oh, it's really hard, it's really competitive to make it onto The Bachelor. We have psychological tests, we have medical tests, we have all this testing, but the most important thing, and then he smirks and he giggles, and he says, the most important thing is they have to look hot in the hot tub. And then they go on and have literally like I don't remember if it was a minute and a half or 2 minutes, but a long time for video, montage of women in bikinis getting in and out of pools and in and out of hot tubs with the cameras panning directly to their breasts and their butts. And meanwhile, there's this sort of chicka chicka pow wow kind of like a soft porn soundtrack in the background. And this is, you know, 8 o'clock network, ABC network. And, you know, so the most important thing he's saying for women who want to vie for a proposal from some guy they don't even know is that they have to look hot in bikinis. But worse than that, while the sexual objectification is happening, there are also these shows, not just The Bachelor, but The Bachelor and Joe Millionaire and America's Next Top Model and Who Wants to Marry My Dad, where we're all in their 30s and 40s. And, I mean, just dozens and dozens of reality programs are portraying women as gold diggers. They're portraying women as dumb as a pile of rocks. They're portraying women as having no ambition beyond being Mrs. Something. They're portraying marriage and love as commercial transactions between some rich guy who'll just take care of some woman, and the rich guy doesn't have to have anything other than a firm wallet and a firm, sort of a firm butt and a firm financial portfolio. Doesn't need to be smart, doesn't need to be charming. You know, Prince Charming doesn't need to be charming, just needs to be rich. And certainly doesn't need to be an ethical person to be considered Prince Charming. Sometimes can even be violent, as was the case on For Love or Money, when it turned out that the guy who they chose as the prince of that show on NBC had been kicked out of the Marines for getting drunk and sexually assaulting a female officer. Then they put him in the middle of a show where 25 women are supposedly vying for his love. And so while the guy doesn't need to be a good guy, just a rich guy, the women don't need to be smart. The women are considered actively stupid. The women are considered only after his money. The women are portrayed as catty and manipulative and not to be trusted, especially not by other women. They set up paradigms in reality TV in which women are not supposed to have any kind of sisterhood with each other, are not supposed to have any kind of kinship. Of course, what does that mean for when you broaden it out into larger culture? If women are not relating to one another well, if women aren't any kind of support systems for one another, well, then there's no possibility for social activism among women, right? There's no possibility for feminist organizing. There's no possibility for rising up and demanding rights. And who would rise up and demand anything, if at all, on any kind of scale, if they're just stupid and waiting for a rich guy to come and sweep them away? That's the notion in reality TV, is that women are empty-headed sex bots who are just waiting for some prince. It's the most regressive sort of 1950s-esque notion of who women are and who men are. It's degrading to both women and men, but it's not just 1950s now. It's 1950s meets 2008. It's Donna Reed meets Kim Cattrall from Sex and the City. It's Pamela Anderson and Miss America mashed up and, kind of coming out with this weird, sickly commercial gloss.
Well, Jen Posner, I've heard this argument before, this criticism made, and usually when I talk about this with my students in classes, invariably a student will say, well, gee whiz, the producers of these shows are just giving the people what they want. This is what the audience wants. And in addition, they'll say many of these programs, the majority of the audience is young women, or a significant percentage of the audience is actually young women. It's not aimed at middle-aged men ogling young women. And I know you get this question all the time. How do you respond?
Well, that's one of the top questions that I get. And the thing that people have to remember, you, Bob, have done a lot of writing about advertising and product placement and the manipulations of marketers. The reality TV genre, people don't understand that. People have started to talk about advertising and product placement and how prevalent it is in reality TV, but they think that product placement has been on the rise because of the many opportunities that reality TV offers product placers. In fact, it's the opposite. Reality TV as a genre was created because of how many opportunities there are to place products. The first major reality show was Survivor, and Survivor was Jeff Probst and Mark Burnett. They had a really hard time getting any network to pick Survivor up, and the networks didn't get it. They're like, well, what, Gilligan's Island? People are stranded on the island, and then they eat bugs? That doesn't sound interesting to us at all. And then they went back and went to all of these advertisers and got hundreds of thousands of dollars of integrated marketing lined up, and went back to CBS and went back to the other networks and said, hey, no, see, here it is. It's because people are on Gilligan's Island, but they're eating Doritos and they're wearing, name brand sneakers. And when they win challenges after eating all these bugs, then they get to win a certain kind of car and drive the car through the jungle. And it's the perfect way to platform showcase particular products in ways that nobody can TiVo through them. And so then the networks, then at that time it was CBS, like, oh, wait, okay, so not only do we not have to pay actors, And not only do we not have to pay talented writers, and aside here, reality TV does use writers. They just use non-Writers Guild writers, so they're underpaid writers. And they're not, but anyway, Network was saying, so we don't have to pay major writers, we don't have to pay actors, we only have to pay one or two producers, and we don't even have to sell many commercials in order to already have made hundreds of thousands of dollars before the show ever even airs and before we sell a single commercial. And then, of course, we can sell commercials. And then, of course, our product placement integrated marketers will also promote our shows. So it's a, you know, it's this way of getting cross-platform attention to a media product as well as all of the advertising products placed within that media product. The reason this is important to understand, the reason that it's crucial to really be thinking about marketing when we and the advertising and the product placement and the ideology and the goals of advertisers and marketers and product placers when we think about who shows up on reality TV, what the programs end up focusing on, how the challenges are crafted, and what the ideology of those reality shows are, because the ideology of marketing and advertising, as you say, Bob, since the 70s when women were first, feminist women were first talking about media as sort of in the DNA of the feminist movement, we've known for decades that the ideology of advertising is deeply, deeply misogynistic and deeply racist. Fashion and beauty advertisers in particular have always had violent and pseudo-violent imagery as a staple of ways to sell clothing and cosmetics and pretty much everything. The notion that women in pain, women in fear, women in even dead has been a huge current in advertising for 40 years. And so then everybody's shocked when it ends up on America's Next Top Model, where an entire episode is built around a quote-unquote crime scene victims photo shoot challenge, where the women are all encouraged and instructed to become quote-unquote really pretty dead girls. They all had to act as if they had been either stabbed or shot in the head or pushed off a roof or electrocuted, and they're, you know, sort of displayed with their bent and broken limbs and blood everywhere in sexy lingerie and, you know, gorgeous gowns. And while the judges say things like, you look great dead, and death becomes you, young lady. And this isn't because it's just good TV. It isn't because this is what the public wants. It's because this is what advertisers have always wanted people to believe underneath their advertising as a way of getting, as a way of raising anxiety and then getting people to believe that those products that they're selling will alleviate that anxiety. So when media say, this is just what the public wants, that's sort of the big lie. The public also wants critical, challenging entertainment and information that is uncensored and unbought, but the public will watch what's on TV because it's on TV. There are tons of shows that have been canceled that have had great critical acclaim. Take an entertainment show like Arrested Development, for example. Huge cult hit, fabulous show, constantly bumped around on the network that it ran on. Nobody knew when it was airing. It was almost impossible for that show to get picked up in large numbers. But people loved that show, and then they were passing it around online, and they were, you know, commenting on YouTube on it, and they were you know, letters, campaigns to tell the networks, beg the networks not to kill the show. And, you know, there are tons of things that the public wants that are not necessarily as financially lucrative to advertisers as reality TV, and so we get reality TV.
Our guest is
not necessarily everything we want. And the idea, the other idea, Bob, that you mentioned, okay, that, well, you know, women go on these shows, young women appear on these shows, and so, you know, how it's, that has to be reality. It's another question that I get a lot. Well, no, yes, people appear on the shows, but that doesn't mean that it's reality. It doesn't mean that it isn't deeply manipulated. But in a certain way, you know, nobody, men and women, children and adults, none of us live outside the culture. And these shows are crafted by advertisers and by crafty networks and crafty producers to play on some of the most deep-seated notions in our culture about what we're supposed to want, who we're supposed to want to be with, who we're supposed to want to be, and these fairy tale notions that they often structure the shows around are really very ingrained, and it's hard to sort of consciously resist subconscious memories from when we were 3 and 4 years old. And then there's also the fact that in the larger culture, we haven't gotten to a place of, you know, complete equity with women and men. Women still make less money for the same jobs. Women are still underrepresented in almost every field in leadership positions. Even though we're present in leadership positions in every field, we're not. We haven't gotten equal numbers. And there's still an epidemic of violence against women in this country. And news media still believe that, say, child care is a women's issue, even though all people, men and women, have children. But, say, global trade is not considered a women's issue, even though women and girls are 90% of sweatshop workers in the world. We have a culture that still doesn't think that women are invested in every aspect of society. And we have a culture that still, you know, promotes Cinderella and Snow White ideology. So when these reality shows play to those deep-seated notions, you know, there are still 17-year-olds, there are still 23-year-olds who've been taught that that's what they should want, that's what they should be. And so, yeah, I mean, sure, there are 15 people who might show up on one reality show, but there are millions and millions and millions and millions of people in the population that have moved beyond those deep-seated notions. But the reality shows are choosing people who haven't and who promise to behave in certain ways.
Our guest,
what the public wants. It's what advertisers want.
Okay, thank you, Jen Posner. Jen Posner, our guest today on Media Matters. She is the executive director of Women in Media and News. I'm Bob McChesney. This is WILL AM 580. The phone lines are open at 333-9455 and 1-800-222-9455. We have a couple callers been patiently waiting. Let's go to the phone lines right now. Line 1, Urbana, you're on the air with Jen Posner.
Hi. First, I just wanted to say thank you for having this show, because I think this really is an under-reported topic that is so important that just does not even get talked about, even in progressive circles. And I think it's so important. And everything that you're saying, Ms. Posner, I just find myself just nodding my head. And your last point about how this is the way to make women feel that this is the way we are supposed to be, I think is a very important point, because I grew up in the 80s, and I feel like in the past 10 or 15 years, the sexualization of women has gotten so much worse, even from when I was younger. And I just, you know, find myself asking myself, what can we do about it? I see it as a backlash against a lot of the opportunities that women have gotten, and here's our backlash. This is what we're supposed to be like, the things that you're talking about. And I guess my question is, like, you know, I find myself at, you know, what can we do about that? Is there something that we can do? So anyway, thanks so much for doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much, caller. And Jen, as you answer that, she raised a good point I'd like you to make sure you talk about, which is, as she said, the progressive community, the left, the blogosphere, the progressive blogosphere, how well do you think they take up issues of feminist issues, wishes of women in politics, and understand politics through a feminist prism?
Well, the first thing, I think that we shouldn't necessarily make distinctions between the left blogosphere and the left independent media in general. I think that there's been a long history of marginalization of ideas related to and politics related to feminist ideology and feminist politics on the left in general, and then on the left in the media, in the kind of media world, we don't do as well as we should. There are amazing attempts. There are definitely, you know, there are exceptions everywhere. Take Celia Talvi's writing in These Times on women in prisons. Take even take Kappa Pollitt's, you know, decades of columns in The Nation. And, you know, there are so many amazing, and, you know, and Bob Herbert in The New York Times writing periodically about gender issues and the needs of women nationally and internationally. But overall, there is this notion, I think, and I've run up against it a lot, not only in the blogosphere, but in the progressive press, that and in the progressive left at large, if we're to be totally honest with ourselves, if we're to be really self-reflective, there's been this notion that feminism is this thing that we dealt with in the 70s and 80s. Now we understand it. And, you know, sexism, it's so passe to talk about it. It's sure. You know, we've gotten to a point where people are now know that they're supposed to say, sure, women, sexism, that's important stuff. Yeah, but we'll talk about that another time. We don't have time to divide ourselves among identity politics. Now we have to focus on the overarching issues. And then the overarching issues is anything that they wanted to talk about in the first place. And supposedly women's concerns are not relevant to whatever those overarching issues are. But of course, women are invested in every single issue, and just as people of color are invested in every single issue, just as men and white men are invested in every single issue, but when women are trying to organize together to gain attention for certain, you know, social, you know, gain awareness or attention to certain social issues or political issues, we're very often faced with the same kinds of notions as we were 30, 40 years ago, that these are distractions. To write about it is whining. To devote resources to it is taking resources away from more important issues. The difference now is that everybody will say that the reason that it's a distraction is that really we've gotten beyond that, that, you know, we dealt with those issues years ago. And I think that that's it's just a new way of saying some very old ideas, you know. But you asked about the blogosphere, and the blogosphere, there are ways in which the Old Boys Network in corporate media is replicating itself in a New Boys Network online. There are certain problems with that. Whenever you see stories about blogging and the power of the new information landscape and citizen journalism, most of the time, not all, but most of the time, those stories will feature predominantly male bloggers and sometimes only male bloggers. And that's a problem because women are more than half of the bloggers in the blogosphere, according to Pew Research. Just in the same way as women are marginalized on the nation's op-ed pages, when news stories show up about blogging, you very rarely hear about women unless you hear the question, where are the women, where are the women? That said, women are everywhere in the blogosphere, and they're doing amazing things, especially political bloggers, and especially even, there's a whole movement that most people don't know about of mommy bloggers. They call themselves mommy bloggers. They're mothers who are basically organizing online and sharing support and sharing stories, not only about how to raise their kids and how to be advocates for their kids' health and all sorts of advocates for their kids' education, but also how to advocate for mothers' rights, how to fight for fair pay. Also, one of our board members at Women in Media and News, Veronica Ariola, is a mother of a young child, and she's a prominent political feminist blogger, but she's also a prominent mommy blogger, and she sees her role as bringing politics into the momosphere. And there's another group that's about to go to the Democratic Convention. They're called the Momocrats, and they're going to be covering the convention for mothers. I mean, and there are beyond the, I just thought the mommy bloggers are interesting to talk about because nobody ever talks about them. But there are amazing political bloggers who are feminist and intersectionally feminist, anti-racist, pro-gay rights, pro-distribution of wealth, women who are taking on very intersected, interconnected social justice concepts from a feminist lens online. There are, we have a blog, for example. Our blog is at Women in Media and News at wimnonline.org. You can click over to our blog. It's called Women's Voices. We have more than 50 writers analyzing media coverage of women in a variety of categories. So we have a science journalist, Keely Savoy, who looks at women, media, and science. And we have somebody else looking at women, media, and immigration. Somebody else, women, media, and pop culture. Somebody else, women, media, and violence. Women, media, and war. The idea being that every issue is a women's issue and can be reported that way, although, unfortunately, too often isn't. We also have women writing about media activism, media justice, and media reform work, and what's going on, how women are taking steps in their communities to tackle these problems in media. And that goes back to, but before I say how we can tackle those problems, I do want to just, one thing that I think is really important that you may know, notice feminists doing a lot is you know, bringing other people with us, right? So I have this moment where I'm talking to you all, so I want to make sure that you all know that it's not just Women in Media and News' blog that is doing really good things around politics and media. It's also, you know, blogs like Feministing, blogs like Racialicious, blogs like Echidna of the Snakes, Pandagon, et cetera. There, we have a huge blog roll on our site, and you can find Viva La Feminista. You can find tons of amazing women doing really provocative, groundbreaking work online about media and politics and gender issues and race issues online.
Jen?
But back to the caller's question about how badly or how much worse the objectification of women has gotten in media in the last, say, 20 years. I think we're probably of the same generation. I was also a child of the late 70s, early 80s, and what we can do about it. I think really the answer is to be, there are a few different answers. The first answer is we don't teach media literacy the way we need to kids and also to adults in this country. So the very first thing is, if you're watching these kinds of programs that I was talking about reality television, that you should be always watching with critical filters on. I'm not going to be the old guy that says, get off my lawn. I'm not going to say, don't watch reality TV if you like it. Would I love people to just not watch it? Sure. But I'm not going to be the crotchety person that says, don't watch what you want to watch. But watch these shows with your critical filters turned on. So, for example, I do a multimedia lecture on college campuses. Maybe one day I'll come to your school, Bob. But I do this lecture on reality TV and race and gender issues. And I tell people that one thing that they might want to do, because I know, for example, on high schools and college campuses, a lot of the time these really degrading shows become appointment television. People think they're hilarious. People watch them in groups. So I say, okay, come up with games that you can use to be media literate and media critical while you're watching. For example, a reality TV drinking game in which before the, you know, and use juice if you're underage. I'm not going to be that person, but whatever. Come up with a set of things to, you know, to take a drink about when, you know, anytime somebody cries for no reason, and take a drink of soda. Every time that a narrator says the claws were bound to come out when women are all catty in the same room or competing for one man's affection, you know, every time a video camera pans into somebody's breasts or somebody's butt when they're supposedly talking about something deeply meaningful in their childhood, take a drink. Basically, you know, decide before you watch that there are these things that you're going to be looking out for, because when you're aware of these notions, then they become it becomes more difficult for these notions to become ingrained in your psyche when you're, you know, critical of them. But then that's on a personal level, right? That's on a media criticism education kind of level. The larger issues that we need to be taking on are around the commercial motivations of media. When media is produced singly and solely only for profit and not at all for the education or the information value for consumers, for citizens, then that is the overarching problem. So, of course, the same solution that exists to so many of our problems in news media exists for so many of our problems in entertainment media, which is we need to take on the media monopolies. We need to re-regulate this vastly deregulated landscape that has gotten us to a point where just this tiny handful of mega-merged companies control everything that we see and watch and hear and have set agendas from the top down on what we're supposed to consider acceptable entertainment, what kinds of information we're allowed to receive, and what kinds of information are censored. We need to be working in media justice organizations and media reform organizations, or supporting them and the efforts that are going on across the country. So, for example, rather than getting, we can't talk about the entire landscape right now, but what I can tell you is I think that one of the most important things that we can do is fight for media justice. And the MAGNET, Media Action Grassroots Network, has a 10-point platform for changing the media, transforming the media for all of us. Women in Media and News is in support of MAGNET's 10-point platform. And I think that their website is mediagrassroots.net or mediagrassroots.org, but you can Google for MAGNET and media and find some of the best thinking in the movement right now from Center for Media Justice in Oakland and Reclaim the Media in Seattle and Manhattan Neighborhood Network in New York and Texas Media Empowerment Project in San Antonio and so on. There are a lot of really amazing campaigns right now going on across the country about how individual people can join collectively to demand better from our media.
This is Jen Posner.
Women across the board.
Jen Posner, our guest today on Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We've only got a few minutes left. Let's get to our next caller who's been waiting patiently. Line 2, Champaign County. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Jen Posner.
Sure. I don't want to take you away from the direction prompted by the last caller, but I did appreciate the time you spent on talking about this humanitarian pretext for invading Afghanistan for the sake of feminism. And I wanted to mention that I think it's actually worse that the myopia of the media is so complicit, because Tariq Ali had an excellent piece in the London Review of Books called The Mirage of a Good War, where he says there's widespread fury among Afghans about numerous incidents of rape and rough treatment of women by ISAF soldiers. And he particularly points out that the behavior of foreign mercenaries like DynCor is even worse. Barnett Ruman, who consults for the State Department, so he's pretty sympathetic, points out that alcohol consumption and patronage of a growing number of brothels in Kabul, particularly by DynCor, is arousing this public anger and resentment in Afghanistan, and is playing right into the hands of, you know, a reactionary Taliban. But it's not being spoken of. You have to go to London Review of Books. It's not even being printed. So I think the media is even falling down worse than you pointed out. It's a shame. I don't want to divert you to this, but I did want to make that point because it's really disgusting. The military mindset seems to have that. I'll leave it at that and let you respond. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, caller. And Jen, we don't have a lot of time left, and there's something I would like you to talk about in addition to what the caller just raised, which you've written about a lot, which I think is an important point, which is this: the question of violence against women is a real crisis in our society that gets neglected by the media and gets avoided. And you've been on, you've written about this, you've been on television shows talking about some of these sort of mass murderers and how they've been driven by rage against women. Can you talk a little bit about that, and why is that missing?
I think it's, thank you for asking about that. I in 1998, I think it was 98, we saw the first major school shooting in this country at Jonesboro. And I wrote at the time, I was in my 20s, I was writing for a feminist newspaper called Sojourner. At the time, I did a Media Watch column about how there was this mass panic in the country, especially through the media, with a lot of hand-wringing. Oh, why did this school shooting happen? What could possibly have been at the heart of it? It must be video games. It must be violent video games. No, it must be rap music. No, it must be decaying family values. No, it must be because there were kids of color involved. It must be that black families don't know how to raise their kids. It must be all of this stuff, right? But nobody was looking at the fact that in that case, in Jonesboro, there were boys who had been saying consistently for a while, no girl's going to dump me. And they went and had been basically mad at some girls in their class, and so they ended up going and killing all the, you know, everybody that they killed were girls and a female teacher, and no one at the time in media were looking at the fact that these were not babies killing babies, just like news stories about teen pregnancy always talks about babies having babies and never talks about the fact that it's a majority adult men impregnating young girls, and that there's, you know, statutory rape involved a lot of the time, et cetera. But that's an aside. But nobody was talking at Jonesboro about the fact that women women and girls were the primary victims, and that the boys were talking about their motivations as being angry at these girls. And I was talking about the fact that if media kept missing the story, because there were also school shootings in Canada where a guy had gone into a college classroom and said, "You're all a bunch of effing feminists," and then opened fire. And, you know, if we kept missing, if we didn't call this femicide, if we didn't call this violence against women at the root of it and then talk about what we need to do to stop this kind of violence from being so prevalent, then we would, if media continued to miss the story, we would continue to see these kinds of things happen again and again and again. And then what has happened in the last decade? Media have never talked about violence against women as being the motivator behind most of these school shootings, which it turns out it has been, except for Columbine, which is, incidentally, the only major school shooting before Virginia Tech that people tended to really remember. Except for Columbine, all of them have had violence against women at the heart of the motivations of the shooters. And at Virginia Tech last year, again, we had all of these, what could possibly have been motivating him, what could possibly, it must be video games, it must be YouTube, it must be the internet, it must be blah, blah, blah. And it turned out he had been a stalker and a harasser of women on his campus. A female teacher had suggested that he get counseling for it. And, you know, when he ended up killing this woman who he had fabricated a relationship with in his mind that didn't exist, the campus police had basically thought it was, quote-unquote, just a domestic thing, overlooked it, which gave him, not overlooked it, but basically didn't think it was a continued threat, just thought, oh, well, he just killed this woman he was dating, which gave him the time to go and kill all these other people on the campus. I ended up going on Hannity and Combs at that time talking about the fact that violence against women was, again, being missed as a major story, as a major, not only story, but major motivator of this violence. And the more we ignore that, the more we allow and become complicit in the continuation of such violence. And, of course, Hannity and Combs were more interested in, you know, something Rosie O'Donnell said about gun control than on anything really relevant to the topic at the time. But I think that, Bob, it's really important that we talk about covering violence against women in serious ways and not just doing what media tend to continue to do, which is blaming victims for the violence when the violence isn't invisible itself. So, for example, I did a piece a while back on the Wall Street on a Wall Street Journal writer who basically claimed that women who get raped and murdered bring it on themselves because feminists have convinced women that they should drink in bars alone, and so therefore feminists are responsible for women being stupid enough to get themselves raped and killed. I mean, that's the kind of narrative we still have in media about violence against women. It's inappropriate, it's unacceptable, and you'd think it would have changed in 40 years.
Jen Posner, we have such little time left, I think just around a minute or so, and I do want to ask you, and unfortunately I have to be in the awkward position of giving you a very, very short answer. We did have a Democratic presidential race this year where the two finalists were Barack Obama, an African-American, and Hillary Clinton, a woman. And much of the concern of Clinton supporters was that her candidate was getting short shrift from the news media for gender reasons. And in a short period of time, what's your general assessment of that criticism?
I think you don't have to be a Hillary Clinton supporter to have seen that media were incredibly misogynistic in coverage of Clinton. But media have also been racist in coverage of Obama, and we don't talk about that much except after the primary was over. We started to have a narrative about that. I've been writing about sexist coverage of female politicians for, you know, more than a decade. I remember in 1999 Larry King Live segment when she was running for Congress about how she had she was bottom heavy and her legs were fat, and how could she win the Senate race if she had bad fashion.
Well, you know, so, Jen Posner, on that very nice and interesting note, unfortunately I have to cut you off. The band's tuning up. We're out of town. I have to get off the air. Can I thank you again for being our guest today? It's been wonderful. We could talk for hours. Our guest, Jen Posner. I want to thank Andrew Boyle, my producer. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll see you in 167 hours. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Thanks, Jen.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
This afternoon in Champaign-Urbana, decreasing clouds with a chance of showers and thunderstorms early. The high in the mid-80s with southeast winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight, partly cloudy, the low in the upper 60s with light southeast winds. Tomorrow, hot and humid, sunny with the high in the mid-90s and south winds 5 to 10 miles per hour with heat indices 97 to 102. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.